every edit is a lie. Well, at least that saves us of having to do a polygraph on Akira. This is CinemaVille. Today we're up to 53 on the Wonders in the Dark Sci-Fi Movie Countdown, with Katsuhiro Otomo's groundbreaking anime masterpiece, Akira. Based on his epic manga series, which ran for nearly a decade in Japan and totals to over 2,000 pages of comics, the film introduced anime to a whole generation of fans and critics across the world, and showcased the kind of hard-hitting, mature storytelling possible in the medium of animation outside of the child-friendly entertainments of Disney and Looney Tunes fare. I'll again be talking with Checker Phil on the eve of his own trip to the Land of the Rising Sun. Now, Akira takes place in the city of Neo Tokyo, rebuilt on the ashes of the original city after a massive explosion triggered World War III and decimated the metropolis. Otomo's vision of the new city has become one of the most influential aspects of his manga and film, a touchstone that's been repeated in countless works both animated and live-action. From Evangelion to Cloud Atlas, there are countless visions of resurrected cities that owe a debt to Otomo's Neo Tokyo. All one needs to do nowadays is add the prefix Neo to a location and give it a bit of cyberpunk flair, something I know only all too well from my own webcomic and animations, Neo Westchester. But Otomo's reach has gone beyond the mere Blade Runner-esque visuals and catchy buzzwordification. Even his prediction of Neo Tokyo hosting the Olympics in 2020 has come to bear fruit with the next upcoming Summer Games, and his depiction of an Olympic host city besieged by waves of violence at the hands of military police against protesters has long since gone from looking like an outlandish futuristic dystopian trope to an all-too-real detail of everyday oppression in the wake of the massive casualties surrounding the Games in Rio, as well as militarized police forces in our own country and around the world. One barely has to look very far nowadays to see how close the present is coming to resemble the dark future visions straight out of John Carpenter films like They Live, and the prospect of our upcoming election making the possibility of a Donald Trump presidency increasingly plausible might make Escape from New York the next item on the sci-fi Nostradamus schedule. I once remarked in a piece on another Wonders in the Dark countdown for the Satire Classic Network that sometimes movies and books we cite as uncanny predictors of the future aren't so much supernatural soothsayers or even genius-level analytical brainstorms, the works of men who see so much gone wrong in the present that they're able to see how it will unfurl in times to come. Rather, I felt, that writers like Paddy Chayefsky or George Orwell might very well have accidentally helped influence and inspire the very future they wanted to prevent with their dire warnings. An example of the Cassandra complex run amok. All it takes is one single civil servant musing on the bureaucratic practicality of an instrument of the state like the Thought Police, or a gaggle of Hollywood execs to look at the rantings and ravings of a Howard Beale without so much as an ironic eyebrow raise, and before you know it, you have CCTV coverage on every street corner, and a television slate dominated by reality TV on one end, and bloviating 2 minutes hate stretched to fill an hour with commercials on the other. If something like this is true, or even inevitable, then at the very least I'll always cherish the storytellers who go out of their way to predict and or inspire the dictatorial dystopias of the future as long as they populate the ramparts with ragtag rebels looking to take them down. And it's why I like to hold up Otomo's Akira as a prime example of depicting not only the bloated, neon-blinded megalopolis of the future in Neo Tokyo, but in the resistance movement he portrays as trying to liberate it from... Well, they're not really all that sure, to be honest. They're a much more clumsy, brutal, desperate, and thoroughly convincing sort of rebellion than the allied forces of the original Star Wars or Matrix trilogies, but also nowhere near as myopically nihilist as Peter Chung's terrorist fashion sketch, Aeon Flux. They stand for something, they fight for something, and what they're fighting against is frequently rather brutal, terrible, and full of hypocrisy. But at the same time, we get to see them as more or less the same thing, only on a smaller scale. One of the early set pieces of the movie, between bike chases at high speeds and hallucinatory anime explosions filling the skies, is when Kaneda witnesses a terrorist bombing at a shopping facility, accompanied by the ironic lilting tune Tokyo Shoeshine Boy. It's a nice little ironic commentary from Otomo, and one that goes a long way both to criticizing his heroes, as well as affording them a little bit of sympathy. Even when Kaneda joins their ranks, he's really no more in the dark than the characters around him, like Ryu or Kei. All of them manipulated by larger forces they have little comprehension of. All they know is that the world, as they know it, sucks. And whatever they can do to change it is worth the risk. That's a future you don't need to bother predicting. And it's one that's always worth planting as an idea in any audience's irresponsible mind. Just as we'll always have romantic figures like Che Guevara, we'll always have ragtag rebels like the ones in Neo Tokyo. Just stay out of the way when the blast radius of that inspiration hits. And now, Akira. Once again, this conversation took place between myself and Checkerfil before the beginning of his red-eye quest to follow J-pop and anime swag off in Tokyo. The original one. Not the post-apocalyptic one, just yet. Here we go.
Hey, Bob.
Hey there, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right.
Got everything all packed up?
No, I'll be doing a lot of packing within the next 48 hours, so it's 48 hours till I leave.
You want to talk about that at all for this, or just skip it over?
Well, I'll probably, you know, it is what it is, so however you want to do it, man. Yeah. I'll talk about more.
Oh, I mean, it's, you know, it's up to you. I mean, like, you're going over to Japan for a little while to see a band. What group is this again?
I'm seeing a group called Bono.
Bono.
Yes, it's a J-pop band that has a couple of members of, if you know the group Very D Kobo, and also a member of the band Kyuto.
Hmm.
They come together as a super group of awesome singers.
Okay, believe this or not, anybody listening, but even though I'm a big anime fan, I know basically nothing about J-pop, and I especially...
You're missing out on a lot.
And I especially don't really know anything about, like, the whole, like, just gathering from what I've seen when I've, like, hung out at your place and everything, I barely understand, like, the idea of, like, a super group. Like if I could understand it, it feels sort of like what you would get, like, if the Avengers and the X-Men came together instead of fighting each other.
With music, yeah.
Yeah. Huh. So
yeah, it's like team-ups, but with music.
Yeah. Are you going to be trying to see any, like, movies or something while you're there? Like, any anime or something that might be there?
Let's see. I know I'm going to be going to the Museum of Animation out there, so I'm looking forward to that, and I'm sure that they'll have sort of stuff running around there, and I'll look to see what's going on. I'll hit up all the areas where we'd have a lot of animation, maybe pick up some Blu-rays and some DVDs, or get a DVD player that plays Japanese DVDs and bring that over to America, try to make that happen.
You do know that we share a Blu-ray region with them, right?
I sure do.
Granted, your Blu-ray player is... not terribly dependable, but, you know.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely not.
It also just occurred to me, I don't know exactly when it's out over there, But you know what's coming out in Japan in August?
Let's see. Would that be the new Godzilla reboot?
Yes, the new Godzilla reboot directed by Hideki Anno, the guy who did Evangelion.
Ah, okay. Well,
so you're getting a chance to see
some live action.
Yeah, so you're getting a chance to see that, and
yeah,
you know, I'm really anxious to see that. Like when it's out over here, I'm hoping that it gets some sort of a distribution. We'll probably just be lucky if it plays like select nights at like fucking Alamo places or something like that. But
you know what? I'm even down to see it even without you know, I won't have the benefit of getting subtitles or anything like that, but I'd see it. I don't care.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, why not? It's more important sometimes, I think, to see a movie like that in the theater than seeing it, like, with subtitles or anything. I remember the first time I watched the Rene Laloux movie, Gandahar. I was watching it without subtitles, but it was still a really good experience because, you know, you're talking about the universal language of weird-as-hell animation. You don't really need everything subtitled sometimes.
And I'll tell you this, and it's a great thing that we're talking about Akira, because all the times I had watched it, most of my life, many times I'd seen it without subtitles. And then eventually I got to see an English dub, and I was thinking, like, hey, maybe that'll make that ending scene seem a little bit more like I could understand it more. And you know what? Nope, didn't understand it anymore.
Okay, when you're saying that you were seeing the movie without subtitles, are you saying that like you were seeing, like a videotape of it when it first came out and it hadn't gotten subs or a dub or anything yet? This is like back in the 80s.
Well, you know what? I think it was running on like Uptown or something like that. It was like they would show it on something like that. Or
okay.
I don't know where. Or you know, there was always spots where you would be able to get back in the days before Blu-rays and before you know, all the this modern technology, there used to be all these stores like on Elizabeth Street and stuff that used to sell videotapes.
Right.
You would get videotapes of Dragon Ball Z and videotapes of Rurouni Kenshin, and yeah, you could get Akira for sure.
You know what's funny? Like back when it was also like being released on Laserdisc, that Akira was one of the first Criterion Laserdiscs.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, back when, like, there, you know, it's really wild to think about the stuff that Criterion did back in the day, and the stuff that they probably would still do now if they could get the rights to things that, you know, have become way too popular to be relegated to this, like, little artsy-fartsy catalog. You know what their, I think their first, their very first Laserdisc release was?
What?
King Kong.
The 1976 version or the...
No. Not one of the remakes. The real King Kong. King Kong. Like the 30s version.
Uh-huh.
So, like, that to me is a testament to what they're willing to do when they're allowed to do stuff. Like, you know, I think to myself, they would probably be all over, like, really mainstream stuff. Like, you know, Star Wars or Blade Runner today. Blade Runner, I think, actually might have been in the Criterion Collection at one point. It's really interesting.
You know what? I'll say this. Also, Laurie Anderson's film, Home of the Brave, was on Laserdisc, along with VHS. And they still have not ever released it on DVD at all.
It is, however, all on YouTube, and it looks pretty good.
Yep. Yeah. You know what? There's a film that always deserves watching.
Yeah.
Can't beat that one with a stick. David Van Tegum, Joy Askew, and a whole other bunch of legendary musicians up in there.
Yeah.
I think Bernie Worrell, who just passed away, too, he was in it, too. Right?
Mm-hmm. I watch it sometimes, and it's like, it's worth, like the Laurie Anderson thing there, it really does tear me apart that one is not out on, like, DVD or anything, because it's just a great piece of performance art, the weird shit that she does on stage, and, like, the shock head and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But you were saying about Akira, so you actually, the first time you saw this, you actually were seeing it in a theater, like Uptown in Harlem or something, you're saying.
Akira?
Yeah.
No, I would watch it on VHS first, but
okay.
A little tiny theater. You know, there's this...
Okay, so there is seeing it in theater.
I did see it in a little tiny theater, and, God, you want to hear the funny part about this little tiny theater? This little tiny theater, I think now it's this big theater on... right around the corner from, I think it was around the corner from Webster Hall, before it was little tiny, like hole-in-the-wall theater that became a big theater. You know, maybe I'm not even remembering it right. Maybe I'm not remembering it right at all.
Anime movies do seem to gravitate towards a lot of the little hole-in-the-wall type places. I remember, like 5 years ago or something, when Evangelion 2.0 was showing in the States, the only theater that it was playing at near me was, like, this very small, hole-in-the-wall sort of movie theater in Manhattan. I'm pretty sure it was, like, the upper end of Midtown, but I'm not sure. It was, like, right, like, in the same area as, like, a whole lot of, like, shopping district places. Like, there was a Bloomingdale's, like, a big fucking Bloomingdale's. There might have been a Saks, something like that. I don't think it was Fifth Avenue, but I don't know. But the crazy thing about the movie theater that they were playing it in was all the posters that they had up and all of the advertising that they had for, like, regular movies, like, week in, week out, all of it Bollywood.
Yes.
Yeah, Bollywood.
I know that place.
Ah, so do you think you saw anything there?
I do remember seeing things there. I can't remember off the top of my head, because it also had another movie theater that was across the street. Also, I'd like to say for the record, Bernie Worrell was not in Home of the Brave. I keep on confusing that for Stop Making Sense, that, you know, they both came out around that same sort of 85, 86 kind of time, like, you know, I just...
They're both these, like, crazy 80s art film, concert films. Easy to get a little mixed up.
Yeah. So I'll just say that to, you know, somebody's going to be there saying, yeah, Bernie Worrell wasn't down the hole of the bridge. Yeah, it's all messed up. I don't want to hear about him anymore. He's just talking crazy.
That is exactly what we need as one of the few comments that we'll get on this Akira piece, somebody yelling and screaming at about Bernie Worrell. That'd be lovely.
Yeah. God bless that guy. He was awesome.
Okay, you also mentioned to me that you wanted to talk about Mr. Robot a bit. Do you want to do that before or after we do Akira?
Oh, no. I was just saying, you were just asking, is there anything else you want to talk about? Yeah, and I just said, yeah, that Mr. Robot was awesome. That's what because I just finished watching the latest episode, and I just thought it was a great thing. I'll go back to, we'll go to talking about Akira. That was just a competition between me and you. That's all.
It's worth talking about here. It's worth talking about here, too. I mean, like, I remember, like, watching it last night. That was the episode that was the episode that everybody, like, saw coming right from the start of this season.
Yeah.
That was the big twist episode. But what I loved about the whole, like, the way they reveal it, the way that they... the way they pull the veil asunder. Oh, I don't even need to talk about it, but, like, the way that it's done, if you took out the dialogue, you would understand exactly what's going on just based on the artistry of the visuals. And, like, the way they pull off those transitions, it looks like some of it is in camera, some of it is just, you know, editing tricks. Some of it might be, like, a little digital, a little mix of things, but almost all of it is done purely based on directing, how the camera is positioned, the composition and the arrangement, and how that then factors into when you have a fast camera movement that brings in all these surprising elements that you wouldn't anticipate at first. It was really, as much as I've seen, like, people online and Twitter sort of, like, bemoaning the fact that, like, oh, do we need to have, like, a big sort of Sixth Sense style or Fight Club style reveal every season, and can we trust...
You're dealing with the show, you're already dealing with the
Fight
Club.
I mean, like, one, I think that those sorts of twists sort of enable the type of... enable the type of highly visual directing this guy wants to do, because, you know, when you have a twist like that, you can go back and look at, you know, it encourages you to go back and look at the episodes so that you can see all of the clues and everything, and it keeps you attended to that the whole time.
It wants you to look back, because I want us to look back at the episodes. They buy the episodes online.
Yeah, most other TV shows, you know, most other TV shows that we have today in, like, our golden age of television, they're almost all script-oriented, and they're shows that you don't even have to look at in order to get. Mr. Robot is a show that you have to watch, that you have to look at. And like, shows, it's like a piece of visual art.
Like an NCI, if we were seeing, like, an NCI or any of those shows, it's like, you have these characters, they do these things, things happen in this formula, and it's already done by the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's based... all these things. It's basically a barely illustrated radio play at times.
Yes.
And
it's like you have to hang off at every second of it.
Yeah. And, yeah, like, Mr. Robot, it encourages you to watch. And, it does that sort of, like, Room 237 thing. Because you have all these people watching the show, trying to figure out what the twist is, trying to figure out what the hell is going to happen next and what it all means, that allows you to play with the visuals in a way that, like, if you didn't have, like, a big dumb twist, like, you know, who is Mr. Robot and who is his sister and everything, then I don't think that the network would be saying, okay, you can do whatever you want with the visuals. You know, he would, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have that.
Like when they did that, that whole 90s show with the, Word Up Wednesdays, that I thought that was amazing.
And, I don't think it's really a 90s episode. I think it's more that part was, that was 80s, because, you know, you had Alf. Alf was not in the 90s. Alf was gone by the 90s.
But then I think that would be late 80s.
Yeah, it's late 80s, because the sister has the Game Boy.
Right.
So you know it's late 80s.
And then I love how they got that USA Network old thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the old opening for it.
Right.
They really were digging deep for that.
You know, and I mentioned this last week, the fact, like, on, like, you know, the intro part, the fact that they're taking advantage of the whole USA thing, that's really smart because, think about it, Christian Slater is one of the main people on the show, and for a while on USA, it felt like every... like, movie they would show had Christian Slater in it.
Right. They were showing Heathers, they were showing all the other ones.
Right. They were showing Heathers, they were showing The Wizard, they were showing Legend of Billie Jean, they were showing this, like, movie where he's, like, a teenage undercover cop called Cuffs or something. There's a lot of movies that he did that are on there. And so it felt really, it felt very appropriate to have all of that stuff there.
It was already the Christian Slater Network, so what the heck, let's just go on.
Yeah, but it's back to being the Christian Slater Network, and that's really nice. But I guess going back to Akira, part of me wants to, like, think of, like, ways to tie these things together, because, like, you could look at Elliot on Mr. Robot and see him as, like, he's kind of stuck somewhere between being Tetsuo and Kaneda or something like that. He's got, like, a little bit of that vibe.
Maybe, you know what? In fact, that's perfect. That is absolutely perfect, because Kaneda is Mr. Robot, while Tetsuo is actually Elliot.
To an extent. It just seems like there's an element, like, in Akira, it seems like there's, like, an element in that movie that, like, you don't necessarily have in the manga quite as much. We can talk about that in a little bit. But the major thing that I took away from this time was there's a big theme of feeling infantilized, feeling like you're made into a child again. That's a constant theme in this movie. And
Right. The kid's room is this big baby, you know, room, you know.
Yeah.
What I mean?
You've got the baby room, you've got the clowns, you could say.
Yeah.
It's also interesting because there's a lot of imagery that was created specifically for this movie that then found its way into the manga because, like, he was doing them out of order, you know, at one point. The ending with, like, the giant mutated baby form, the infant form when he's mutating, that's part of the ending that he came up with for the movie and then said, okay, so I'm eventually going to do that in the manga. So the whole movie is based on this theme of Tetsuo feeling dependent on people. He's dependent on Kaneda for protection. He's dependent on the state for this education that isn't really taking him anywhere. And eventually he's dependent on, you know, the government and the military for these drugs that are sort of like keeping him at bay. And, you know, without which he goes completely, you know, he goes completely haywire, completely nuts.
Yeah, and he's also even dependent on his little relationship with Kaori, and then he ends up absorbing her in the end. And I love you so much, like, let me just take all of you here, you know.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, and that's another, like, thing, like, you know, it's funny, like, that's one of the other visual motifs that you have in the movie, is, like, being absorbed into things. You know, because, like, you have Kaori is absorbed into his body. You have, you know, Kaneda is, like, absorbed for a little bit.
Yeah, into there.
And, like, even, like, the scientist at the end, he, too, is absorbed by, like, all the machines around him and, you know, crushed, of course. But, you know, it's a very similar visual. And that, too, is sort of an image of infantilizing. Because, like, it's, like, being absorbed by the body is, like, returning to the womb.
Yes, there's a lot of this imagery going on in here.
Yeah. But I'm a little more curious to hear, like, you know, some of, like, your first coming into Akira, because, like, I can remember very specifically how I first came to Akira. I just, like, I was on a vacation with my family up in New Bedford. We were, like channel surfing. I was channel surfing with some of the older kids, and they found Akira playing on the Sci-Fi Channel. And it was, like, right in the middle of it when Kaneda and Kai are, like, on the, like, that flying platform thing, and they're, like, in the sewers, and they're trying to find where Tetsuo is. They're trying to find the baby.
Sure, yeah, I love that whole, like, the camera goes, like, 360 in that.
Oh,
shot.
Yeah. I mean, it's a beautiful sequence. And it's also, like...
In the middle of the shot, it shifts to a shot of Kyoko, like, psychically seeing this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? In the middle of that shot. Like, they get that in and get her in there. Like, she's suddenly aware. And then she gets in there to reach out mentally to Kay.
Yeah, there's a lot of really cool stuff there, and the fact that was like my first introduction to it, like you're having all of that thrown at you, you have no context for it, but you know you want to see the rest of it because it's just cool as hell, and it's no animation you've ever seen before.
During right before that shot, remember that shot where Kay gets her first kill? She shoots that guy. And that scene in the sewers, right before that, like, you see that he is, Kaneda's in there, and there's that, it says in the background, like, in English, written in graffiti, fuck you! And it's like, when I saw that, I thought, like, they are basically saying that to American animators. Like, fuck you guys, this shit is awesome. That's all I'm saying right there.
Yeah. That wouldn't surprise me, especially because, like, at that point in, like, American animation, like, Disney was, like, falling apart in, like,
yeah,
the mid-80s.
Yeah, 88. So, let's see. What was going on? What was Disney putting out in the 80s?
Here's how it was going on in the 80s with Disney. First thing they do in the 80s is they do the Black Cauldron. And that bombs. That bombed spectacularly. It was their first attempt to do something that was, like, a little bit more mature, that was more like a PG-13 to, like, the G or the PG movies that they'd done before, and it tanks.
Right.
And it looks like it's going to bankrupt Disney for a while. So after after they do the Black Cauldron, this is sort of like a casual, loose history of it, but after they do the Black Cauldron, they make significant fires. They fire a lot of their animators. And they fire some of the big names. Like, they fire Glenn Keane. They fire other people like him who've been there for a really long time. Don Bluth, too, maybe. I think that was around the time that, like, Don Bluth left Disney.
Who did Great Mouse Detective?
No, that was somebody else. That was the guy who later went on to direct, he later went on to direct, like, Aladdin and some stuff, but it was not the guy who did Grace Mount's Detective. But, like, I mean, like, this was around the time that, like, Don Bluth left Disney to go do, like, you know, he did, like, Dragon's Lair and Oh, okay. Like that other game, you know, he did, you know, An American Tale and, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So he was moving on to greener pastures for a little bit. But, like, what's interesting is that a lot of the animators who were at Disney then and who were fired had to go and, like, do other projects at this time, you know, around those years. And I think, like, the same year as Akira, or, like, a year before, like, it's, like, 87 or 88, a uh-huh. lot of the old Disney animators, including Glenn Keane, found themselves working on, of all things, the Chipmunk Adventure.
Right. I mean, because 88, if I'm thinking 88 when Akira first dropped, the big thing was Who Framed Roger Rabbit? But also, you know what Disney's big thing was? Oliver and Company.
That was that 88 or 89?
88. Hmm. And because in 89, then they got their mojo back with Little Mermaid.
Yeah. Yeah, they were already beginning to get it back a little bit with, like, The Great Mouse Detective. That got a lot of good reviews. Mm. That was the first movie that they did with CGI at the end.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like
first
the clockwork.
But that was 86.
Yeah. Yeah, but I actually really find the whole thing that, like, happened with, like, the Chipmunk Adventure really fascinating, because, like, you go back, you look at that movie with the knowledge of all the different animators who worked on it,
mm-hmm.
you really come to appreciate it a whole lot more. Like, a lot of people look at, like, the Chipmunk Adventure today and just look at it as pure, like, nostalgia fluff, and if you look at it just based on the story, yeah, that's kind of true. It's a dumb story. The songs are, like, fun in a nostalgic 80s kid sense. But the thing that's really cool about it is to look at it and see the work of all the different animators who are, like, storied names for, like, Disney aficionados and even, like, more mature animation aficionados. Like, one of the animators who worked on the film is somebody who was a big collaborator with Ralph Boschke. You know him?
What did he do?
Ralph Boschke, he did the movie version of Fritz the Cat. He did...
Ralph Bakshi.
Bakshi. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Okay.
Ralph Bakshi. Okay, if you're talking Ralph Bakshi, yeah, I know.
Okay, Ralph Bakshi. I mean, he's got a K in his name. How the fuck am I supposed to pronounce that? But one of the animators who worked on, A Chipmunk Adventure... is one of his old, like, his big collaborators on a number of projects. I think she worked on, like, the Lord of the Rings movie he did. I'm pretty sure she worked on a number of other things with him. And she was going to be his main storyboard person on Cool World before it got turned into, like, a grown-up Roger Rabbit thing. It was going to be, like, really just,
right.
like, a hardcore film noir piece of animation. Her name is Louise Zingarelli, and I think she's passed away, unfortunately. She's, like, really, you know, you look at the work that she did, and it's really just kind of jaw-dropping to see the stuff that, you know, the stuff that she's responsible for. There was some, like, interview that I read that she gave with somebody where, like, they were talking about the work that she did on the Chipmunk Adventure, and I'm pretty sure on that movie she did a lot of the animation for, like, the adult characters, especially, like, the kind of, like, Euro-trash villains of the movie, and there were some people who looked at her animation and said, so what kind of rotoscoping did you use for the movie? And she said, I didn't use rotoscoping, fuck that shit, I used my imagination.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was using. So this is, there's, like, it's just really fun to see, like, the depth of what these people can do when they're on completely different projects. And, you know, I guess it's worth, you know, mentioning now in the light of, I guess, how visible it is that animators are being taken advantage of on a couple of other projects that you could probably think of.
Every project, man. Animators are getting ripped up all the time.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I'm thinking, like, specifically of, like, you know, what is it? Sausage Party has been in the news a lot now, and that's just sort of sad to think about what's going on, like, right there. You know, you'd like to think that, you know, people, you know, they're contributions to something like this are being taken really as seriously as possible, especially the people like us who actually want to kind of break into that in some sense. But
sure.
I don't know, even on something like, you know, the Chipmunk movie or some of these other kind of like Disney fluff things before they had their great renaissance with the Little Mermaid, it's worth looking at all of those and realizing.
No, I would like to say for the record that the Chipmunk adventure was not a Disney thing.
No, it wasn't a Disney thing. That's the thing. When Disney fired a whole lot of their staff after the Black Cauldron debacle, the people who did the Chipmunk movie, they were able to scoop up a lot of those animators at a bargain rate and give them work. So that's why you have people like Louise Zingarelli or Glenn Keane working on the fucking Chipmunks, something that they never would have been able to get before that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you can have a lot of, like, the Disney polish on that movie and it not be a Disney thing. And, you know, at the very least, if you ever have to watch a Chipmunk movie for some reason or another, like somebody's got a gun to your head and they're speaking to you in a helium voice.
I used to love the Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah,
I really did.
I think Louise Zingarelli worked on some of that too. That was one of her.
That was one of her Medici games. They designed the Chipettes and stuff like that. I thought that was great because they were kind of like the Go-Go's.
Yeah.
I mean, I love the Go-Go's.
The Chipettes are definitely a holdover of when that show came out. You look at that and you know this is an 80s show. Because they've got the lip.
I mean, they have the leg warmers and all that stuff, yeah.
Yep. Yeah, so it's funny to look at that. Just as it's funny to look at, like, when you look at, like, the credits of any given anime out there, it's fun to look at that and see the different production houses that'll come up at the end. Because you do that and you'll see there's a lot of cross-pollination between a lot of the big anime houses in Japan. You know, it might be a Studio Ghibli work, but don't be surprised to see Gainax involved. It might be, you know, Studio IG. Don't be surprised to see, you know, Studio Ghibli or Madhouse dropped in there.
You know, that's the same way it is in America. Like, you know, they have these, you might have this one studio working as it, but somehow Nelvina had their hand in it, or, you know, all these other, you know, everybody knew everybody. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They loved each other or hated each other or both.
Yeah, everybody knows each other. Everybody works with each other. And at the best moments, you can see it, like, bringing out the best in them. On Akira, there's a few cases where you can see characters go off model for, like, a shot or two. Like, I'm remembering there's, like, a shot in the middle of the movie where Tetsuo is trying to get information out of the Esper kids, like, the little kids who are also old people.
Yeah.
And he turns his head, and his nose looks so fucking wrong for, like, one shot or two. Do you know the shot I'm talking about?
That's the thing about that.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know it when you see it in the movie, but it goes by and you don't really think about it as much. But it is funny just to see those little moments where somebody goes off model, and you can just, like, chalk that up to, well, this must have been given to, like, one of the other production houses who weren't entirely in the loop or something is a lot of the other things.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, let's get down to the nitty-gritty, because I'd love to talk about Akira. Let's get in.
Okay. Well, one of the things that I was thinking about when watching the movie, you know, this time is just, it's funny to see how much the camera is moving throughout the movie, which is not something you get in a whole lot of anime movies. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
usually,
yeah, like I was talking about that 360 move that they did, and other great shots.
Yeah, and the camera in this movie is very mobile, both for those literal moments where you can tell that they have to move the camera on their rig, or they have to move all the assets on the rig to, you know, facsimile a camera move. But also, there's a whole lot of movements in the movie where they're animating a camera move in the cells. You know what I mean there?
Right. Well, what I
like they're animating like a push, or they're animating a change in perspective.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Like with the psychic ability kind of stuff, they would do stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm thinking like
that's what I love. A good example of with Tetsuo on the bike, trying to kill this version of Kaneda on the bike trying to kill Tetsuo, who's now transforming into this gigantic big baby who can't stop himself, and he's trying to get him, and it's just like, you see the baby in the background, blurry, well, you have Tetsuo skidding into the foreground, it's just such a beautiful shot.
Yeah,
you know?
Right, and I'm thinking, specifically of, there's a couple of moments in the movie where you can have these camera movements that are animated in the cells so subtly that you might not even notice it at first. Near the beginning of the movie, when Tetsuo has crashed his bike and he's looking up at the first of the old wrinkled kids, and he's reaching out at him saying "What did you do to me?"
Right, he's looking like Takashi, right?
Right, Takashi, and his bike is in flames.
Right.
You look at that shot. Again, and I noticed it the last time I saw it in the theater, the camera is pushing in on him, and you can see they're animating, the little pebbles that are going past the camera as he's looking up and reaching out. So,
right. There's a lot of that little pebble stuff, too, that was going on. And any shots with the destruction and things like that.
Yeah.
But also, there's another beautiful shot, simple shot. It's really, really, really simple. I think it's Ryu, and they're in this kind of underground spot, and they're gonna break into the place, and they give these cards across the table to him. And it's a very simple shot. They pass him these cards across the table, and he picks up the card, and you see just the faintest bit of dust coming off the card.
Yeah.
Coming off the card. And at the same time, a bike or a car passes through the window outside.
The light going by.
I'm like, really? I mean, and dust too. You're just really. That's just showing off that you're so awesome. That's all I'm saying here.
Well, you know what it is? It is taking the fullest possible advantage of doing an anime movie at 24 frames per second on one for the whole time. Mm-hmm. It seems. Which is something that you rarely see being done with anime, especially back then, especially for a first timer, a relative first timer like Katsuhiro Otomo. He had only done animated shorts at that point. He had done Labyrinth Stories with a couple of other guys. He had done, Robot Carnival, but that's all he'd done. Everything that he'd done before that was manga, and that was manga that he was doing himself. And assistants like Satoshi Kon, but for Akira, it's fascinating to think about, this is the shape that he wanted for Akira, this fully animated movie with pretty smooth animation for anime, 24 frames per second, lush animation, lush illustration. There are many,
definitely.
Many...
It's one of the biggest icons of all time. This show.
Right. Well, the thing is, there are many, many, many other anime out there that are based on manga, like Akira is. They're never directed by the guy who wrote and drew the manga, like Akira. That's very rare. Otomo is, he did the manga, and he does the anime. That's one thing that you never see. What you also never see is something this... Right. You never see something this... lushly animated, this expensively, this expensive a production. Like, when you have a manga that's popular and they're going to make an animation of it, I mean, you know what it's like. It's going to be something that's, good and fun, but choppy, Dragon Ball Z, any of the Takashi, the Rumiko Takashi series, Yurusai Yatsura and everything.
Yeah.
And what always happens then is that you have something where they go out of their way to tell the entire story of the manga on an episode-by-episode basis. It's something that's usually given to a young, director cutting their teeth and, their creative team. And that's that's generally where you tend to get a lot of your big names in animation, Hayao Miyazaki and Isao Takahata, they cut their teeth as directors working on the Lupin the Third animation, which was great,
mm-hmm.
but it was based on the Monkey Punch manga. And what's interesting there is that they wound up doing something that over time was very, very different than the Monkey Punch comics, which could be very kind of lurid and mature and kind of dark and gritty. They wound up doing something that was kind of bright and friendly and, you know, funny and stuff like that. Then, of course, you have, you know, and we've talked about this before, you had Mamoru Oshii on Yorosai Yatsura.
Yeah.
You know, when he was doing the TV show, that was pretty close to the manga. Then when he did the movies, it wildly departed, and he got kicked off of it because of Beautiful Dreamer, which was basically its own original thing and had almost nothing to do with the manga at that point. It's interesting to think about what things would have been like if you had had, you know, a more traditional version of Akira being done. If you had had Akira done as like a TV show in like the late 80s, going into the early 90s probably, because it would take that long to do all six books of Akira, we might have wound up with an anime that was telling a faithful version of the story. Because
I tell you, it was so big, with so many characters.
Right.
I mean, we're not even
so many characters, so many subplots, so much stuff. I was thinking,
why couldn't they get Chiyoko into some of this thing?
Oh yeah,
I would love to see all the people cosplaying her.
Right. Right. And also think about like what is it? I can't even remember her name, but like, you know, the. What is it? The lady something or other.
Lady Miyako.
Lady Miyako. Right. She right.
Yeah, sure.
She's a major character in the manga, a huge character.
Right.
She's the fucking Yoda of the manga, and here she just winds up as this joke of a character, this parody of a character, and it's interesting to see that. It's like it feels like at that moment Otomo is saying using this character to say. Hey, yeah, you remember this character that you love so much in the manga? Well, she's dead now. Bye.
Yeah.
This is not the manga.
Yeah.
This is its own thing.
They were just destroying everything in sight.
Right. It's his willingness to depart from it and do the parts of the manga that he can within a feature time limit. And that's kind of admirable that he's willing to throw out what doesn't work in order to do his own thing. And it's also worth remembering that even though the ending of the manga has a lot of the same elements, like the baby and everything, a lot of those things were born here for the movie. So there is a little bit of, like, the snake eating its tail by the end.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What do you mean, everything absorbing into itself?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, like, because... You had to have the ending of the movie to have the ending of the manga.
Right. Exactly.
You know, so
they had to finish it up somehow.
Yeah. But I mean, like I was saying, it's tempting to think of like how it would have been if you had had like a more traditional version of like Akira, the TV series. And, you know, it's interesting for me to think of like who would have been the director of something like that.
You know what? And they've been talking about a live version of it for the longest time. And you know what? Out there, I think there was a person that did like a fan thing of it that looks great, man. They had the bike and everything. It looked awesome.
I haven't seen this, but I mean, like everything that I've heard about for a live action Akira is like for a big Hollywood version of it just sounds worse and worse.
Yeah. Actually, I think they did a parody of that with an American version of Akira.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I'd almost rather see, like, The Simpsons just go on and do full-on Bart Akira.
You know what? Actually, there was a Simpsons Akira thing.
Yeah, I know.
A magazine, a book. That was fantastic.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's interesting to see how much time people devoted to that, considering that it's basically... the greatest invitation to a copyright infringement lawsuit ever made. And also, like,
awesome,
yeah, but I mean, the other thing is when I look at that and I think to myself, look, if you want to do a Simpsons version of Akira, that's fine. That's a great idea. But don't just do, like, a literal frame-for-frame, word-for-word version of it. If you're going to do the Simpsons version of Akira, throw in some fucking jokes. You know?
Yeah, you know, they were just getting serious with it, but you know what? It is what it is. Oh,
yeah.
Here's the little information. The if you want to see the live action Akira thing that actually looks good, it is called the Akira Project, and the director is Nguyen An Nguyen. So I'm pronouncing it wrong, but definitely look him up.
That sounds like Vietnamese or something. What?
Yeah, this guy was awesome.
Mm.
So you know, live action. Oh gosh, you know, in 2016, this Warner Brothers might finally do a Akira live action adaption. Yeah, right. Well,
I think that it's a little early to count those chickens, especially
Johansson is K.
What? Oh.
With Scarlett Johansson is K. Now you know I'm just joking here.
Yes, I know that you're just joking, yes.
Uh-huh.
Although, of all things, I could see them doing an international version of that. Do you know at one point they were talking about having, literally, for that movie, they wanted to have Morgan Freeman as the Colonel, and Helena Bonham Carter as Lady Miyaka.
Really? The one that I always heard was Leonardo DiCaprio. That's the one they were always throwing around.
Yes, because when you hear a name like Kaneda, you really think Leo.
Well, you know what? They were trying to get Keanu Reeves involved in something like this. And, oh, here's the best one of all, Justin Timberlake.
I remember hearing Keanu Reeves wanted to do Cowboy Bebop at one point.
I can see that.
Yeah, I mean, Cowboy Bebop, actually, that's one of those anime that you could get away with casting a white guy because, he'd be playing somebody named Spike Spiegel.
Yeah. Well, yeah, sure.
Yeah, so. But, like...
Who would you cast? Now, if you could cast anybody, who would you cast?
I just wouldn't do it.
Mm-hmm. You think it should not be done?
Yeah, I mean, either you don't do it, or, like, you'd have to do it, like, for, like, HBO or something so you could do the whole thing. And at that point, you're probably just better off going with unknowns anyway.
Yeah, I think anything, if you're going to do anything with any sort of, what we call it, just use unknowns.
Yeah, look at what happened with Game of Thrones. Did we know about any of those fucking people except for,
nope,
you know...
And they're all awesome. I mean, give me a break. That little kid that they had playing, what's her name? That Bear Island chick? She's awesome. She's tiny.
Yeah. But now I'm, like, thinking, like, you know, going back to just, like, the quality of the animation here, it's worth looking at, like, the different types of animation that they use in this movie, especially for, like, the big physical stuff, because you don't just have a lot of the frame-by-frame animation being used. Like, whenever they're, like, riding their bikes through the city and stuff like that, especially early on, you see, like, a lot of shots where, like, you just have, like, the skyscrapers moving by, the holographic advertisements and the neon going by. A lot of that is being done just with simple plane movements, where you just have, like, a flat drawing being moved across the screen, and there's no change in perspective, and, like, it looks great. It looks great to see these, like, things being moved, but that's what makes those other moments when the camera is being moved inch by inch, frame by frame, to give you an actual pan across a building so you can see, like, the shift in perspective. There's a moment in the movie where Ryu and Mr. Nezu are talking to each other, and they're, like, walking along a bridge, and in the background you can see that building begin to shift just a little as, you know, you're changing in perspective. Now, that's a moment in the movie that, you know, Katsuhiro Otomo, he didn't have to animate that. He didn't have to have his animators go and do this, like, frame by frame. It's probably, like, 100 drawings or something that they had to do to get that moment on screen, or more than 100 drawings. What am I saying? Like, if you've got 24 drawings per second, I don't know how many seconds it takes for them to do that shift in the shot, but, like, you know, just think about all the effort that goes into that one scene, that one moment. Like, you know, I remember, like,
and that's not even a major scene.
It's not a major scene. It's an incredibly minor scene. It's incredibly minor. It's like,
but they, you know what? That's what they did in a lot of scenes. Any scenes with just people just talking heads, will do stuff like that just to show how frustrated they are and to keep your mind moving. Like when I tell you, when they're talking about the plan and they pass the cards and they do that thing.
And
they have that little light come across. They're keeping you interested. It's keeping you there.
And it's also one of those things that helps you appreciate why other animators and why other productions will resort to just having like a shot that's completely static for a really long time, because, you know, a production like Akira can get away with, you know, this like high production quality animation on every single moment, on every single beat. But, you know, you're doing something else. You know, you're doing something like, you know, Evangelion, which was already sort of like a budget production when it started and was only losing money and losing advertisers the more it went on in its initial broadcast. You understand why they hold their shots and they hold their poses a lot longer than something like Akira, and especially a lot longer than something like a Disney production, where they can just afford to burn through money. They can just, yeah, I mean, like, you know, like, you remember the moment that I described from, like, 101 Dalmatians, where they're just, you know, they have, like, people animating the same pose, the same drawing, frame after frame after fucking frame, just so this guy can look at his watch.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And why did they do it? Because they could.
Right, because they're Disney. Because they're Disney, and they don't have to cut corners. Now, at the same time, it's lovely to see a moment like that where you're seeing, like, this heightened attention to reality being paid to this, you know, ordinary, simple little human moment, like looking at your watch and smoking your pipe. But not everybody can afford that. Not even, like, the fucking Looney Tunes could afford that. Like, Bugs Bunny would stand around in the same pose for a really long time while, you know, Daffy Duck is, like, exploding at him and yelling at him, because if you're going to have these two characters on screen, only one of them is really going to be animated at a time. Because, like, the Warner Brothers people, they're working on a budget. And that's the difference that you have here. Otomo is working based on, you know, the amount of money
he was able to raise.
He's working at an almost Disney level. That's what's so amazing here. Akira is as close as any anime has gotten to a Disney-level budget. And
well,
even then, it's probably not quite up there.
He said this is his life's work, so he wasn't going to skimp on that.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's fantastic that it wound up becoming as big a hit that it did over here, and like just in general. But it does get to be a little sad when you realize how rare that sort of budget is, even for animations like that. Come out today, there's a lot of really good looking anime that are being done, but unless they come attached to like a major franchise, like, you know, Gundam, where you've got the toys, or Sailor Moon or whatever, they're going to have to cut corners. And it's always, just as much as it's awe-inspiring to see a movie like Akira not have to do any of the cut corner stuff, it makes it all the more just inspiring in general to look at something like an Evangelion and see how they cut corners to enable their own awe-inspiring images on their budget.
True.
Yeah. But, like, what...
So
what
now let me ask you.
Okay, go ahead.
All right, I want to ask you, like, if you could pick one shot from the movie, one scene from there that you think is, like, the epitome of this, like, your favorite scene, if you have a favorite scene, what would you say is your favorite thing?
I think I would probably have to say...
And there are so many.
Right. I think I would probably have to say, like, the final battle in the Olympic arena, because it combines a whole lot of the stuff that makes the movie good at once. You've got the bike chase stuff. You've got, like, the lasers. You've got, like, the morphing, mutated image of, like, you know, Tetsuo. And you've got a whole bunch of the characters there at one point, in one place. So there's a lot of stuff that I think is really great there. The fact that you have an ending that can juggle all these different things and even introduce new stuff, like, you know, the monstrous Tetsuo destroying the ground so that, you know, what is it, Kaneda has to ride his bike up on, the flying concrete and stuff. That, you know, there's a lot of really cool stuff there. And the fact that it then blends into this ending that is, you know, really, you know, it's so surreal, it's like transcendental. And it's like a religious experience, that ending.
My favorite scene is where what is it? They get like a satellite to try to stop Tetsuo, right?
Yeah.
And he just like, what? what? Like they dropping all this stuff on, and then he blocks it, and luckily Kaneda just happens to be in that force field.
Yeah.
You know, and then as soon as he leaves, then everything starts falling, which is such a beautiful scene, because that's another one you can see, like, the smallest rock to the BB gigantic big rocks, and it's such a comedic scene.
Yeah.
You know, all these things are dropping. And then it cuts to Tetsu in space, and he's just, like, walking up the side of the thing, and it's just like, listen, bitch, that's it. And he destroys that whole thing. And my favorite scene is the part after that, because he's pissed off over this whole thing, because they friggin' shot his friggin' arm off. And then as you see, like, the remnants of this satellite falling from the sky, like in little meteors, and in the foreground, you see him, and he looks up, and he just recreates his hand out of technology. And
with the sun setting behind him and everything.
Right, right. And it's like, yeah, it's like the hairs on my arm are even standing up now, because that, even everything, even the music that's in the background is kind of...
Oh, yeah.
And it's just like...
The whole thing,
music, everything together, just so beautiful.
What's so great about that little scene that you're talking about is that it's a rare breather moment, a pause in the action that you have after this huge avalanche of action that you've had throughout the whole movie. Like, the middle section of the movie can be a little exhausting sometimes because, you know, in one scene, they're infiltrating the top secret headquarters, and they're getting on the flying platform to go find the baby room, and they're flying through the pipes and the sewers and the superstructure. And then, Tetsuo is fighting against the other psychic kids after having this huge, like, hallucinatory sequence with the big teddy bear and the Lego bricks and everything. And then, like, Tetsuo, after he escapes from there, he goes into, like, the street, and he's fighting tanks and helicopters, and he's got this whole army of people behind him, and this cult of followers and everything.
The bullet from the tank, that's an awesome scene.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, on so many levels. But then, like, he goes to the underground base and lifts the giant, you know, steam pipey thing. In that, like, one half hour of the movie, there is more happening than you would see in most, you know, live-action action movies. You know, that thing is, like, it's full to the brim with action. Part of it is because it's, like, it feels like you're getting the best moments of the manga all stuffed into, like, 2 hours, so that 130 minutes is going to be, like, full of action nonstop, like, for a while. But it's good to have that breather moment where you have... You know, the colonel is seeing Sol fall apart in the sky. You know, Tetsuo is creating his limb with psychic energy. There's a lot that's just really beautiful in that pause. And especially,
and I think in this scene, like, Kyoko is doing like a voiceover, right? I think she's like, you know, kind of explaining what's going on, right?
A little bit. Yeah, they're beginning to regroup, and then, like, you go to you know, Kaneda and Kai and Kaisuke, and they're, like, charging up the batteries for the final battle and everything.
Right, right.
Right, so you not only get that, but you get, like, a final little breather moment of, like, just interpersonal comedy between those characters. So, you know, there's a very good attention to that sort of detail in the movie, and attention to pacing that's really essential in a movie like this where all of civilization is falling apart.
So epic. Exactly. It's so epic. The destruction is so epic here.
Yeah. The one thing that I think about, though, when I think about this movie, and especially comparing it to the manga, the one thing that I think the movie falls apart with a little bit is towards the end, like, after this whole stretch in the movie where Tetsuo has had his, like, followers, and now he's just, like, you know, blissing out at the Olympic Stadium. From that point on, it kind of feels like all of the civilians of Neo Tokyo have just kind of vanished, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, they all said, get the hell out. You know?
Yeah, but I mean, like, it's a very stark contrast to the manga where, like, half of the manga is all about how civilization has collapsed, the new order that has risen, like the new Tokyo Empire, and what day-to-day life is
like. The gangs are more important in this situation.
Right, but what's cool is that you get to see in the manga how people are living in this new Japan, how the world is reacting to it, because you've got this international group of scientists who want to try and create peace. You've got the Americans who are sending an agent in to kill Akira or Tetsuo if they can, and is willing to start like biological warfare or something. There's like a billion things going on that obviously you don't have in this version here. But also at the same time, I think it is funny that when you have the new explosion starting and you've got like the, you know, tsunamis crashing in the buildings and everything,
we're not,
we don't see anybody else. Like, as much as people like to complain about, you know, Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman and like Superman doesn't care about civilian casualties and all that stuff, at least in that movie you saw, in those movies you saw what was happening to the civilians.
Oh yeah, tons of civilians were catching it over there. But you know,
here,
animation and not real people.
Right. And it feels like, I guess, the last moment that they want to have for the civilians is that moment, like, on the bridge where you have all the followers are just sort of crashing into the sea and everything. And it's a testament to the quality of the movie throughout that when all those civilians are no longer a presence towards the end of the movie, you begin to wonder, wait a minute, where did all these people go? Because the movie is so good throughout the rest of it, admittedly, this is like the 15th time or 20th time I've seen the movie over, you know, the past couple of years, because it seems like it's screened every other weekend now.
Yeah, well, you know what? They can't mess with perfection, so go for it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you don't have, you know, the presence of the civilians there and what's happening to them. And it feels like sometimes one of the things that I think you've seen in a lot of other anime that's popped up is people wondering what happens to the civilians, what happens to everybody else. And I think that's something that especially has popped up.
How do they rebuild their life?
Right.
That's how they come to that ending scene with Keisuke and then they drive over to like the colonel and stuff like that, right? They're all like together and they're like, what are we gonna do with our lives?
Right, but I mean, like, that's just not like on the individual level. We know what happens to Kaneda and Keisuke and Kei, and we know what happens to the colonel, but as far as we know, they're like the last people alive.
Everybody's gonna be fighting over Kei. You're gonna be my woman now.
Right. But I mean, like, it's funny to think of like that compared to, like, say, End of Evangelion, where Hideki Anno goes to explicit, horrific lengths to show you, yep, this is the end of the world, and here's what's happening to everybody on the planet, and we're going to cut to, like, a big shot to show you, yep, this is happening all over the planet, and you've seen that happen in, like, other things. Like, you've seen that, like, it feels
Titanic,
like...
Titanic. Everybody's carriage is dying. Everybody in the richest people are dying.
Right, well, I'm just talking about anime right now. But I would say, like, another example of this is, like, Attack on Titan, where, yes, you have your heroes who are going to live, but everybody else is being eaten by these giant fucking monster things, and we don't even know what they are.
Okay.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, like, that's funny to me, to see, like, this is a movie, Akira, that has such an eye to both the personal and the epic that when you begin to lose the epic masses of crowds, you wonder where they go on a human level. Like, it reminds me, earlier in the movie when, like, they're first breaking into the top secret base and they're, like, using their cards and they're, like, going in under disguise, their leader says, you know, like, he's pretending to be just an ordinary working guy, and he says, you know, well, I've got vacation time coming to me, so I wanted to do the work now, and I'd have to come back here anyway and get overtime. Whenever I watch that scene, My thought is not, oh no, is he going to get away with, you know, his lie? My thought is really more, really? He's got vacation time? Where's he going to go for vacation in post-apocalyptic Tokyo? Right. I mean, like, what is it? 20 years ago, you had World War III. So where is it that you're going to go on vacation? That, I think, is a, you know, it's a testament to the movie. It's a compliment to the movie that you're thinking to yourself, literally, where is this guy going to go on vacation? And you're trying to construct this little narrative in your head, not because you're questioning its integrity, but because you're thinking to yourself, oh, it's interesting. I wonder where you go for vacation in a world like this, where all of the other cities
like
of the world are like...
cursed Earth.
Yeah. I mean, like, I guess he's just going to go visit the ruins of other places.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now I have a question. Can you walk me through the end of Akira right now? Now this is according to Wikipedia. They have a nice little neat little blurb. It says over here, at the Olympic Stadium with Tetsuo in immense pain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Tetsuo has grown beyond the requirements of a coherent dialogical form.
Yeah.
His fears awaken Akira, right? Remember that he's in the jars, manifesting himself from the canisters, right?
Yeah.
Akira reunites with his friends, and they trigger a second psychic explosion, dragging Tetsuo and Kaneda with it. As Tetsuo struggles against Akira's pyrokinetic powers, the ESPers teleports Shikishima away from the stadium, and Kakashi leaps into the explosion. So, alright, Kakashi leaps in there to rescue Kaneda, and to aid the other ESPers aid in the effort at the cost of being unable to return. Alright, I get it. In the explosion, Kaneda is now experiencing Tetsuo, him as a person, his feelings, and the ESPers' childhood flashbacks. So he sees all the flashbacks, including how much Tetsuo trusted Kaneda and how the children were trained and altered before Tokyo's initial destruction. All right, I get that part. Now the next part. His peers help Kaneda escape and inform him that Akira will be taking Tetsuo to safety. I didn't catch that. Kyoko reveals that Kei has begun to develop psychic powers. Okay, I didn't catch that part either. The explosion destroys most of Neo Tokyo, killing Onishi in the process. In the aftermath, Kaneda discovers that Kei and Kai have survived, and they drive off to Neo Tokyo while Shishikima watches the sun rise over the city. Tetsuo comes into control of his powers, and he triggers a big bang in an alternate universe. What?
If you remember in the movie, the scientist, the last readings that he's able to read before the whole thing collapses on him is, you know, he says, if these readings are correct,
it's over 9,000.
Right. He's saying, no, but what he's saying is, the computers are saying this is the creation of the universe. So his instruments are telling him that a new Big Bang is being triggered on some, like, quantum level.
Right. Oh, that's right. And then at the end it says, I am Tetsuo.
Right. So that's like his let there be light in that new alternate dimension.
So he's like God.
Yeah.
He's like God of this alternate. It's very, like, very interesting. Like, you remember the movie Watchmen. Like, Dr. Manhattan is like, I'm tired of being here in this world. I think I'm going to go create my own universe.
I'm going to go create my own alternate version of the DC universe right now.
It is already it.
Yeah. But I mean, like, I think that this is something that the manga goes into a lot more detail just on it on a philosophical basis. Like, it introduces the ideas of these powers being a manifestation, not just of a new step in evolution, but it mentions it as something that is tied to man's soul, tied to infinity, tied to God and everything. So this is a lot of the stuff that you get from, like, the Lady Miyaka portions. What? This is the stuff that you get in, like, the Lady Miyaka portions of the, or Lady Miyoko, or, like, portions of the book. And one of the very, like, one of the big images that's a repeated motif in the manga is that image sort of, like, of all the speed lines heading into infinity that you see once Kaneda is inside the explosion bubble. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Uh-huh.
All the glowing speed lines.
Right.
That's
right.
An image that you have in the manga at Lady Nyaka's temple. You know, she has this huge boss relief that's like a still version of that. And it's uh-huh. the same image that you have on that throne that Tetsuo sits at the Olympic Stadium.
Right.
All the speed, the sculpture of all the speed lines, you know, converging into one point, like the hyperspace image, you know, that's a
right. That's the one thing that they go to in the end.
Right. That's a key image throughout the manga. And what's interesting about that is that because it's a manga, you get an image like that all the time anyway from, like, the, when they're riding the bikes. So
right.
you have that, like, God element, that spiritual Zen moment element of the, like, the infinity hyperspace thing. That's a constant throughout just because of the use of speed lines.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, you have an aesthetic repetition of that throughout the book. You have characters talking much, much more about the spiritual ideas of the book and the philosophy on that level. So that's why it makes a little bit more sense what's going on in the book rather than the anime, where it can all feel just a little bit sudden. It feels a little bit sudden, doesn't it?
Yeah, it feels like, what the heck am I watching? Especially a guy like me that didn't know any Japanese at all. I'm sitting there going, what the heck's going on?
I still can't believe that they didn't have any subtitles at all the first time that you watched it.
You know what? And then I'll tell you one thing. Well, you know, because I was originally watching it on VHS, like I said.
Yeah.
But by the time that I finally seen it with dubs and with English subtitles, and you know what? It didn't get me any closer to understanding that ending. But now, by reading this little situation and talking it over with you, I think I could go to sleep at night and know, finally, after all these so many years, I'm beginning to sort of understand it.
Yeah.
Sort of.
The other thing that you mentioned, the thing with Kai, that is like, she's also a psychic, but she just doesn't know it.
That's something, exactly. That's how a homegirl was able to, Kyoko was able to speak with her, because she knew that she was kind of waking up this latent psychic ability that she had. She
right.
taking her under the wing.
Yeah. And what's interesting to me is to watch this movie now thinking, like, the first time I watched the movie when I was younger, of course, whenever I saw the Colonel, he seemed to me to be the villain of the movie. Because he's like but then as you, like, watch it getting older and everything, like, you see, oh, well, he's not really the villain. He's like this big authority figure, but he's not necessarily a bad guy. He's just trying to keep control of Neo Tokyo as it's falling apart. Now when I watch the movie, the first time I watch the movie, you know, in like the longest time, I look at it and I think, actually he is sort of the bad guy of the movie. He just doesn't know it. Because think about it.
Right.
If they hadn't, you know, started experimenting on Tetsuo, he wouldn't have turned into this big, you know, threat. He wouldn't have turned into a monster. He is the monster that they created, essentially. And as much as
but everything was going on exactly as it was supposed to, because Akira was supposed to eventually be reformed anyway due to all the things that were happening.
Yeah.
So it's like the universe was going exactly according to plan.
Yeah, but I mean, the other thing, of course, is that, you know, Akira did not have to be experimented on back when he was a kid, too. So
the Colonel is very much
just like all those people back, you know, 20 years ago or 30 years ago or, you know, however long the movie takes place. He's just like all of those people. He just doesn't really know it or want to accept it.
Right.
And I guess, you know, the scientist gets, you know, a little bit of, like, a short shrift here. And he doesn't fare any better in the manga, either. Like, when was the last time you read the manga?
Right. His name is Dr. Onishi.
Yeah. When was the last time you read the manga? Because I know you own the Japanese version.
Yeah, the Japanese version of it. And you know what? Like, I used to own... Actually, you have my copies of, right? Do you have the copies of my English one?
What? You used to have the color versions, and then you gave away all your comics, and you didn't tell me that you had the color versions of Akira.
Sorry, man, but
you did not tell me that.
Dude, I didn't know you wanted them. I'll tell you this.
I'm stuck with Preacher with the version that isn't the Ruth Negga version of Tulip. That's what I got.
All right. It's you know what? Luxury problems, my friend. Luxury
problems. I know.
I'll say this. That was that Marvel comic was of Akira. It was one of the first comics colored by computer.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's some big history right there.
And I didn't know about this until recently. I had always thought that was sort of done, like the color version was done without Katsuhiro Otomo's permission, and that he wasn't really crazy about it. No, I think it was done with his permission, wasn't it?
Sure. I mean, you know, he's in the guy that closely controlled all his stuff. In fact, I remember actually him being at Forbidden Planet when it used to be across the street from where it used to be for, I guess, anybody in New York City. It used to be on it used to be a two-floor store that used to be on the other side of, I guess it would be the eastern side of it. No, the western side of the street.
It was two floors. Yep. They used to have a whole lot of, they used to have all the anime stuff on the second floor, didn't they?
Sure. And I remember Otomo was there doing a signing. Yeah.
When was this? How long ago?
I didn't get a chance to meet him, but the line was too long.
How long ago was this? Do you know?
I don't know. It had to be maybe early 90s. Early 90s.
So this might have been around the time that he did Memories or something.
Could be.
God, I mean, like, speaking of, like, you know, just Otomo in general, how much of his other animation have you seen? Because I know that you've seen Memories with me. Yeah.
Yep.
Did you ever see Steam Boy?
You know what? I didn't see Steam Boy. I didn't. You know, I was just not into the whole steampunk sort of thing, though I did really like that last thing that I thought, that French steampunk movie. What was that thing? That was
April and the Extraordinary World.
Yeah,
the Jacques Tardy one.
You got a talking cat. I'm in there.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, you sold me on it.
Yeah, that was a good one. But I mean, like, but what's interesting there is that was very, very French steampunk. That was like aggressively French steampunk, of course. And like this, like Steam Boy is an interesting movie to go back and look at, because it's such a mix of different things. Like, you have this, like, young, I think he's supposed to be, like, a young Welsh boy who's an inventor, who's, like, getting caught up in this, like, sort of, like, war between other inventors, where one of them is sort of, like, a steampunk cyborg, which I'm not really sure how that works, how you can have parts of your body and parts of your face are powered by steam, but whatever, it looks cool. And he winds up teaming up with, like, this, like, alternate fiction version of, like, Scarlett O'Hara, sort of. It looks like...
Really?
Yeah, there's this little girl, there's this girl that he teams up with who is named Scarlett.
Does she have a mammy with her in the whole nine?
I don't think she has a mammy with her, but she's supposed to be American. She's supposed to be,
really?
Like, a wealthy little spoiled girl heiress.
Okay.
And... you know, like I said, it's like an alternate version of her, or like an alternate version that's like inspired by her type or something, where she has like this whole army of steam-powered robots, and they're trying to get like a new business contract over in like London or something, and they're having like a little steam war or something. I don't really remember a whole lot of it, but like, it's a movie that's worth watching at some point, you know. In fact, since I've got the DVD, maybe I'll bring it over someday, because do DVDs work on your player?
So, yeah. Don't bring a blue disc, a Blu-ray until I get my new one.
Yeah. That's I still can't understand what the fuck is going on with Mac on that. Really, you know,
dude, don't even get me started. That is a podcast for another time.
But I mean, like, it's strange to look at like just how little Katsuhiro Otomo has done besides Akira, because like he's done that, he's done the other stuff, like, you know, Robot Carnival and Memories. The other major like animation that he's done, like, in the past, you know, however many years, you know, he did another anthology movie called Short Piece. Did you see that?
Nope.
His animation in that one is really interesting because it's all set in like medieval Japan, really, really interesting to look at, like all about fire and stuff. It's, you know, it's a really attractive little short that he put together. The other big, like the other animated feature that he worked on, like from the past 25 years or something, is something called Rōjin Z. You ever hear of that?
Rōjin Z? No. That's 1991 he did that one. He did that before Memories.
Yeah. But you know Rōjin Z, but you haven't seen it?
Nah, haven't had time.
Rōjin Z is really interesting to look at. Rōjin Z is basically, Japanese medical company makes a new medical bed for seniors that is supposed to take care of all of their, you know, concerns and all, take care of them. And like it hooks up, and it hooks up to this like old guy who, you know, his wife is dead, his kids don't care about him, and the medical bed has artificial intelligence, so it comes alive and it starts to wreak havoc around the city as it's trying to take him, you know, to like this, you know, take him to some place that he wants to go or something. And it's a really funny little like social character piece because you have all these different generations of people coming together.
Pulling me in there.
Yeah. It's funny because I remember
it's about a renegade medical bed. I don't know. You're not pulling me in.
You've got to see it's you know what it is? Did you see Up? Mm. The Pixar movie Up?
I liked Up.
Fuck Up. Fuck
really?
Up. This is better than Up.
All right. I'll take a look.
Yeah. This is the better movie. Like, this is like, I remember when
That's
I saw...
Harsh words, my friend. Harsh
yeah,
words.
I remember when I saw Up, I really enjoyed Up until they got to the stupid Adventure Island where you have the talking dog and the Zeppelin and all that stuff.
I like the talking dog.
The best parts to me are about, you know, the old guy in his house that is supported by balloons and everybody kind of going crazy over that. When it actually gets to the quote unquote generic adventure part of the movie, that's when it kind of loses me because up until that movement, you had an adventure. You had a unique thing going on. And that's the thing that I like about Rōjin Z. The whole, you know, like the majority of the running time in Rōjin Z is all about this haywire medical bed running amok in the city with this old guy strapped to it and everybody trying to make sense of it. And that's the thing that I find so interesting about the movie. And it becomes a movie about all these different people of different generational backgrounds reacting to it and trying to see if they can help. Like, you've got these young college students that want to help the old man. You've got this, like, baby boomer era sort of guy trying to take control of the old man for what's good for him. He's doing it from a good place, but he's kind of like the colonel in Akira. He's all about control. And then you have this, like, younger, but not young, upstart, like, yuppie character who is very, like, me generation, and all he cares about is getting as much money out of this old guy as possible. All he cares about is selling this new thing to the military or whatever. And that's, you know, and that's it. He doesn't care if the old man dies. He doesn't care if a whole bunch of other people die in the process. He's just happy if he's getting money for his big corporation. So it's a perfect movie to watch and get a whole lot about, you know, both Japanese, but I think also international, concerns about the elderly and just generational concerns on any level. You know, I think it's a movie that you can understand both from the Japanese perspective and from over here. It would be very, very easy to have a remake of Rōjin Z set in America. The concerns are all very much the same. We've got, you know, nice young kids and douchebag yuppies over here too.
Sure. All right, this just in. I don't know how accurate this is. I'm just throwing it out there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. In January 2016, Katsuhiro Otomo revealed in a French comic festival that a TV anime series is being considered.
Of what?
For
what?
Akira. For Akira.
Okay, let me look this up, because that could be interesting, because that would mean we're going to be getting the old school anime version of Akira that was talked about before.
And you know what? George Takei weighed in 2011 saying that when they were talking about casting people, he said any decision to cast white actors in Akira would offend Asians and the fans of the original manga.
There's a bit of truth to that. I mean, I think you could pull off some sort of like an international version of Akira.
Yeah,
especially
like Joker and stuff like that,
right,
sure.
Especially if you wanted to get international money or something, but at
sure.
the very least, the lead characters, by all right means, should be Japanese, and for fuck's sake, it has to be set in Japan. But like, this is interesting, the idea, like, this is an animated series that you're talking about, right?
Yeah, they're talking animated series.
Okay, that will be very interesting to see. Like,
mm-hmm.
there's a part of me that wants to see that. There's a part of me that worries a little bit, like, is this something that he's going to work on himself, or is this something that, like, he'd be just producing?
It doesn't say. You can look at the article. It's at techmag.com. 2016/0027.
Oh, there's a lot of different
yeah.
articles I see here coming up on that. But like that is definitely something that I'd look forward to, especially
sure,
if he's
yeah.
still involved. And if he's making the announcement, he must be involved.
Well, of course, well, you
yeah.
get that link, so sure, he's making sure. And you know what? If he had his fingers in all the pies from all the different things that he did involving Akira, and he knows this is his life's work, for real.
Yeah.
So he's going to want to make sure that this is done right. Now, let's see. The year before, Hollywood Reporter said that they were working on a film version of Akira, and Marco Ramirez, known for one of the showrunners for Daredevil, will write the film, supposedly. Warner Brothers offered George Miller the chance to direct the film at one point, but he turned it down because of commitment. We'll see.
Well, that's probably for the best, because what people really want to see from George Miller right now is Furiosa. They want to see more of that.
Yeah, make another one. I want more.
Yeah, I think everybody wants more Furiosa.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Money. I've got too much on my
mind. And that's it for Akira, number 53 on the Wonders in the Dark sci-fi countdown. Next time I'll be handling another of my favorite sci-fi director's classics, though not from the storied saga you might be thinking of. Until then, this is Bob Clark from CinemaVille reminding you, remember to vote, remember to buy more, and be happy.
Maybe I won't go either. Paper says rain. Morning. Morning. What do you people do? Sleep in this place? The boss in yet? Mr. Jelonek has not yet arrived, Millie.
As if she didn't know it.
Are you still here? I told you to get the stamps.
Well, it's about time this one horse company broke down and bought a mailing machine.
I could have had another cup of coffee. Believe you me, I need it. And just 4 hours sleep.